Of all the places in the Bible, I think Genesis chapter 6, 7, and 8 are some of my favorite places in the Bible. It's an exciting story of the Noahic flood, and we're going to be looking at that over the next several weeks. We're going to slow down our pace a little bit and take our time and look at some of these details. Perhaps all of you, maybe only some of you, are aware that there's a secular movie out called Noah that just recently has gone to the movie theaters. And it's important for us to use godly discernment when we evaluate things of this nature. And I appreciate the articles that I found on Answers in Genesis that have evaluated the film. They have seen it. They saw some of it before it came out, and they've seen it since it came out, and wrote an extensive article. And if you would like to read the extensive article, just go to Answers in Genesis, and you will find that. But I want to read one paragraph out of their article, because I think it's helpful for us to understand what is taking place. The paragraph was entitled, "Misrepresenting Mankind's Sin." The filmmakers do show the sinfulness of mankind, though in the film, mankind's wickedness has more to do with how humans are destroying the environment and animals rather than their sin of rejecting God and mistreating their fellow man. The way the filmmakers choose to portray man's sin distorts the Bible teachings. Noah's character, for example, and he is portrayed as a psychopath, and most importantly, the character of God. The movie is filled with mystical, pagan elements, blasphemy, and disturbing scenes. For example, they claim that Methuselah was a type of a witch doctor. Because of these things, we cannot recommend this pagan movie at all, much less for children to see. I know this was a quote. I read it directly from the quote from the Answers in Genesis. And I think it's important for us to understand that. I value their interpretation of, or their evaluation of that on our behalf. Now, I want to just give you some suggestions, and I'm not the Baptist Pope, but these are some suggestions that I think can be a help to you and an encouragement to you. Seven reasons why you should not go to the theater and watch that Noah movie. All right, here's seven reasons. Number one, because of the evils that the Answers in Genesis article has just pointed out. I think that should be sufficient enough to stop us. Secondly, it is produced by a godless Hollywood movie industry. Number three, the director is an atheist and is not promoting biblical Christianity. His goal was not to help Christianity out in any way, shape, or form. It was to make money, and you can be sure of that. Number four, viewing an unbiblical account of the flood will twist your thinking. Now, that might be one of the most important reasons why you shouldn't watch it. Because, you know, we've all seen things in the past that have forever distorted our view of things. We'll never look at it the same way we did before, because now we've got these other ideas in our mind that somebody's put in our mind that weren't right. And it's hard to get those things out once we've gotten wrong ideas in our mind. Number five, supporting the theater is supporting the X-rated movie industry. I think that's a good reason not to ever go to the theater. Attending a theater is bad for your Christian testimony. People that see you go in there don't know whether you're going in to watch an X-rated movie or Bambi. And the Bambi's not always good anymore. So you need to be careful with that. And then number seven, your money would be better spent on a DVD from Answers in Genesis if you really want to know something about the flood. You'd be far better off doing that. All right. So those are seven reasons why I don't think you should go. And I hope that you'll use some biblical discernment as those things come more to the forefront in our community. This morning, we're going to begin a study on Noah's flood. And Genesis chapter 4 and 5 have laid a foundation for us. Remember back in chapter 4, we saw basically, you could say chapter 4 is about Cain's genealogy, about Cain's descendants and how mankind from Cain's perspective turned away from God, turned their back on God, and went further and further and further away from God. And then chapter 5 is more about Seth's line, and they were the ones that continued to follow God. Now, they had their problems, and they had their hiccups, and they weren't all great, but there was a lot of them that were going in the right direction, headed toward doing what was right. And so we have the Canaanites and the Sethites, and two different directions, both of them descendants from Adam, and how they were falling away on the one side and trying to stay right with God on the other side. So that gave us a foundation for the material in the flood. But today we're going to look at reasons for Noah's flood and that are found in the Bible. Why did God send the flood? And there's a lot of reasons. We're going to be looking at several of them found here in chapter 6, verses 1 through 13. And this morning, as we look at these reasons, I want you to be watching for parallels between things that were taking place in Noah's day and things that are taking place in our day. And as you see the parallels between the two, it ought to urge us to prepare for judgment. Judgment's coming, folks. It is. And a far worse judgment than the flood. Now, the flood was a severe judgment, but the judgment that's coming is far worse than the flood. And we need to be prepared for judgment day. And so keep that in mind as we look at this. First of all, I want us to start out, verse number 1, and we'll see the very first thing that we find as a reason is intermarriage. Verses 1 through 3. Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply in the face of the earth, and the daughters of were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair. And they took of them wives of all they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. Now, as we begin to look at this, the first thing that God tells us is intermarriage was causing a major problem and breaking down the holiness and righteousness of the world at that time. The sons of God married the daughters of men. Now, for centuries, there has been debate over who are the sons of God. There's one group of biblical theologians that are saying the sons of God are the angels. There are angels that came down and intermarried with men. And the reason they say that is because in the book of Job, it talks about Satan being one of the sons of God that went into God's presence and talked to God. And so based on that, and I think there's one other verse, they say that the sons of God are speaking of the angels. And somehow angels came down, intermarried with man, and as a result, giants evolved and rebellious people evolved and things of that from their posterity. All right, so that's one view. The other side says that the sons of God are the sons of Seth, the godly line, the good men that are trying to live for God that have intermarried with the ungodly and turned their back on God. So there's those two views. And I believe that it refers to the godly men. And I want to show you some reasons why I believe that. I think there's some good reasons for that. Although, if it was cut and dry and perfectly clear, there wouldn't be an argument over it. But here's my reasons why. Number one is that God strove with who? In verse number 3. Look at verse 3 again. Read it for yourself. My spirit shall not always strive with angels. Right? Is that what it says? No, it says it was man. My spirit will not always strive with man. All right, so God was saying, my problem is not with the angels. I've already taken care of that. He says, my problem is with man. All right, so that's one of the reasons why I believe that he's talking about intermarriage with mankind, not with some angels or super, angelic type beings. The second reason is that the Hebrew word giant does not necessarily refer to an oversized man. Right? Can, and I'm not saying it never does, but it doesn't have to mean that. Sometimes it refers to a bully or a hero or a fierce warrior. And I think there's some good reasons for us for suspecting that in our passage here, and I'll be pointing that out in a few moments as well. The third reason is that the Bible says that angels have no gender. Angels have no gender. All the time when you read in the Bible, you know, an angel spoke unto him, it's always refers to him as he. But when you evaluate it and look at the circumstances, God's not saying the angels are men. He's just indicating that they have no gender. We find that more clearly described in what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 22 and verse number 30, where Jesus said that the angels never marry. The angels cannot marry. He says that when we get to heaven, all Christians will be like the angels in heaven, which neither marry nor are given in marriage. All right, so if the angels never marry, they're never given in marriage, and God never calls them a female, God always refers to them as man, we can kind of put two and two together that these angels probably didn't have any gender like we do, and they were not able to marry. So if angels are not able to marry, then how could they intermarry with man? I find real problems with that. So these are my reasons why I believe it's the sons of men are sons of God are referring to the believers in that day, the ones who were following God. Now, if you disagree, that's fine. We can disagree peacefully, but that's my reasons for that. Now, as we continue on here, the sons of God were the godly line. The sons of this godly line of Seth that we saw back in chapter 5 began to marry the ungodly women of their day. We see that in verse number 1. It came to pass that the men began to multiply in the earth, and their daughters were born unto them, and the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took of them of whom they chose, and the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man. So God had a problem with what was taking place. God had a problem with what was taking place. Things were not going right. Now, one of the things that we notice here is that it says that they chose wives based on beauty, not on character. You know, that is something that is still a problem in our day today. Many marriages that are having struggles and problems today are struggling and having problems because they chose each other based on beauty or looks rather than on character. If you marry someone based on their looks rather than on their character, you are destined for trouble. Because it won't take long and you get tired of their beauty, and then all you're stuck with is their character or lack of it. And then you got problems because you thought, oh, he was so handsome, but now he's so mean, or he's so unkind, or he's so ungodly, or so he doesn't love him, you know, God like he should. You should have thought of that before. See? Now, marriage is something very, very important. God says marriage is permanent, and marriage is something that we need to be very careful and cautious about. And so God tells us throughout the scriptures that we are to choose only those who are godly for our spouse. And a person that marries an ungodly person is in big trouble. They're making a big mistake. Then we notice also something else that goes hand in hand with this. Look at verse number 3, or verse number 2. And it says, and they took them wives of all they chose. Who's the they? The individuals. You say, well, that's normal, isn't it? No, it's not. You look throughout the Bible, and all through the Bible, we find that parents are involved in helping their children find spouses. Now, I'm not suggesting that it, you know, that we have to, mom and dad have to just go out and say, all right, son, you're old enough to get married. We're going to go find you a wife today. We'll bring her back this afternoon. I'm not suggesting that has to be that way, but mom and dad better be involved. And you know, one of the reasons that mom and dad are not involved many times is because we have reared our children to live independent of us, and we don't have their heart, and they don't care whether mom and dad like their choice or not, and they're going to go find whoever they want to do. And many times you take a 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old young person, they do not have the wisdom, they do not have the direction and the understanding to make wise choices all by themselves. They need help. And parents have been around for 20 years more than they have most of the time, and they can give godly counsel and help to those young people if the young people will listen. And I think that's very, very important for parents to get involved to help their children choose their spouses. Now, we see here that God was unhappy with what was taking place. There was an intermarriage between the unsaved and the saved, if you want to call it that. They didn't necessarily refer to it in that kind of terminology in those days. But the believers were marrying the unbelievers. And it was causing problem. It was causing friction. It was happening because they were choosing who they wanted to marry based on, she looks nice and I like her. And they were basing it on that rather than on character. You know, what do I mean by character? You know, when you young people, when you start, you know, there's no sense in even getting interested in a person until you're old enough to marry. Because you get interested prematurely and it'll lead you astray. You're far better off waiting until you're old enough to marry and then start thinking about a spouse. But there's nothing wrong with praying about it far longer before that. But you need to have embedded in your mind what you're going to be looking for in character. I want someone who controls himself. Someone who loves God, someone who walks with God, someone who wants to serve God, someone who has character in their life as far as controlling their lifestyle, controlling the way that they dress, the way that they act. You know, we're talking both male and female now. You know, the girls need to be watching the guys and figuring out, you know, what kind of a character is he? What, how does he respond? You know, one of the ways that's very important for us to remember, a young man that will not obey his parents and they does not treat his mom and dad with respect, you can mark it down, he will not treat you with respect either. He won't. And a young girl that is snotty to mom and dad and don't want to obey them and don't want to do what they're told, she will not be a humble, submissive, godly wife for you either. Now, many times young people are blind to that and they say, oh, yeah, but he's so wonderful. You know, he'll change for me. They're dreaming. That is a false impression. It doesn't happen. It always gets worse, not better. You find a fault in him, you better be very careful because it'll almost always get worse. I've had people say, well, you know, I'm going to change him once we're married. It will not happen that way. It'll cause you grief. And there are people in the room today, if you want to talk to them about changing their spouse after they're married, you go talk to them. That if they've married an unsaved person, they'll tell you what it's like to try to change their spouse. It doesn't work. It'll give you grief. Don't do it, young people. You wait for God. Wait for God to lead you. The Bible says that marrying the ungodly person is destructive, and it's just as destructive today as it was in Noah's day. We read in the Bible multitudes of verses that give us instruction on this. Amos 3:3 is one. It says, can two walk together except to be agreed? You cannot go the same direction unless you're in agreement. And if you're not in agreement, you're going to have problems. We find also in the New Testament, 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14, be ye not unequally yoked together with an unbeliever. Now, a yoke was something they would put over the necks of two animals. And they would hook a plow on it behind. And if they unequally yoked, you get a big, strong, muscular ox on this one side and a skinny, scrawny calf on the other side. What's going to happen? It is not going to work. That little skinny calf is not going to keep up his half of the work, and it's going to cause problems all the way through. And the same thing is true being unequally yoked spiritually. You get an unsaved person on the one side and a saved person on the other side, and you're going to butt heads about spiritual things. You're going to butt heads about rearing children. You're going to butt heads about resolving conflicts. You're going to butt heads about money. You're going to butt heads about everything because you're not on the same wavelength. God says, don't do it. Don't do it. So we can learn from this. Intermarriage is big trouble when you intermarry with an unsaved person. Now we see in verse number 3 that the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man. For that he is flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. We find here that God was displeased when the people intermarried with these unbelievers. And God says as a result, there's going to have to be judgment. And he told Noah, 20 years before Noah's boys were born, he said, Noah, 120 years, judgment's coming. And maybe I'm reading into that. He tells us there. Later on, introduces us to Noah. Perhaps he didn't tell Noah for another 20 years. All I know is God says there's 120 years before judgment's coming. And Noah knew about it, certainly knew about it for at least 100 years, perhaps 120 years. All right, now, the first cause was intermarriage. The second reason for the flood. Look at verse number 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. And the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown. Now, these men became giants. Now, God does not judge people for being oversized. All right? God does not have, you know, this mentality, hey, you're bigger than everybody else, I don't like you. Now, that's not the point. All right? So we know that it wasn't just their size that upset God. All right? Just because somebody might be 8 foot tall instead of 6 foot tall doesn't mean God's got his curse on him. That's not it at all. So God is not upset with their size, so we can assume here that he's upset with something else. And I believe here that because the word giant doesn't have to refer to their size in their stature, and it can refer to their fierceness or their their giant rebellion against God. I think there probably has more to do with that. Now, they may have been bigger people than others. I'm not saying for sure whether it had anything to do with their stature, but I think for sure we can see from this passage that it had a lot to do that they were giants in evil. They were giants in rebellion. They were giants in refusing to obey God. They were giants in disobeying God. You know, either way, they were spiritual rebels. And rebellion begins in the heart. Rebellion begins in the heart. It always begins in the heart. They had a heart problem with God. There was something wrong deep down inside. They were rebels against God. And God was upset with them because of this. Now, it says that they became mighty men of renown. Mighty men and men of renown. Now, the sons of God married evil women, and their children became giants of evil. Fierce rebels. Anti-God society that they lived in. And they became mighty, strong, and brave. It says that they were men of renown. The word renown has to do with fame. They were famous. Everybody knew about them. Hey, you know about those big sons of so-and-so? Ah, yeah, everybody knows them. They're those big, mean, ugly guys that are always beating up people and causing... Yeah, they were men of renown. And so they were. They may have been bigger in size. I can't say for sure, but one thing for sure, they were bigger in their fierceness. They were bigger in their meanness. They were bigger in their cruelty. And they were against God, and they were destroying the world because of their evil and their wickedness, and they're following these wicked things. And we'll see more of that as we move on in the next verse. You know, rebellion is something that God hates. You know, as parents, you need to nip rebellion before it starts in your children's lives. Rebellion is something that children often struggle with. They really do. But if you allow rebellion to cultivate and grow, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, a little bit of rebellion, you know, every kid that goes through rebellion. No, that's a lie of the devil. That's a lie of the devil. Rebellion is sinful. You can read about it in 1 Samuel 15:23. God says this about rebellion. He says, for rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft. Now, what did God think about witchcraft? Anybody know? What did God think of witchcraft? He said that all who were involved in witchcraft were to be put to death. Put to death. Now, God says rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft. You can't equate it to much worse. God says, I hate rebellion. And rebellion will destroy a society. Rebellion will destroy a home. Rebellion will destroy your life. If you have rebellion in your heart and you're rebelling against your mom and dad, or you're rebelling against society, or somehow you're rebelling against God, you are going to be the loser. Because rebellion will destroy you. It will hurt you. And God hates rebellion. So we find the second reason that God sent the flood was rebellion. The third reason God sent the flood is because of wickedness. Verse number 5. All the way down through verse number 10. Verse number 5 says, and God saw the wickedness of man, that it was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and creeping thing and the fowl of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. And Noah begat 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, as we look at this, we see here God tells us in verse number 5 that man had a problem. He said God saw the wickedness of man, that it was great in the earth, and that every imagination of his thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. We see 2 things about God in this verse. We see, first of all, that God sees all that we do. He sees the things we do in secret. He sees the things that we do when we don't want anybody else around. He sees the things you do in private. God sees all that we do. But not only that, but it tells us that God knows their thoughts. He knew that the thoughts of man were only evil continually. God knows my thoughts. He knows what goes on in my mind, not only what goes on in my body. God doesn't have to wait until I act it out to know what I was thinking in my mind. And that ought to bring us into fear before God. God knows us, and He will hold us accountable for what we think about as well as what we do. You know, many people have the idea that as long as I don't do it, it doesn't matter what I think. That is a lie from the devil. Because God says that it starts in the heart, and the heart is fed by the mind. And if what we think about in our mind will pollute our actions, and it'll pollute our character, and it'll pollute all of us. And God says that we need to be careful with that. That's why you read in Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 23, it says, "Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life." See, God knew the thoughts of their heart. God sees all about us. He sees all that we do. Psalm 139 is a great chapter to read and memorize. Psalm 139, verses 1 to 4 especially, says, "O Lord, Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and my uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my mouth, O Lord, that Thou knowest not altogether." He said, "I know all about you." We need to remember that God knows that. Proverbs chapter 5 and verse number 21 is also another fearful verse. Proverbs 5:21 says, "For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and He pondereth all his goings." The ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and He ponders, He thinks about, He observes, He watches all our doings. See, God knows all about your life. God knows all about my life. We can't hide anything from God. And God saw the people in Noah's day, and God saw the wickedness of man, that it was great in the earth, and every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. God said they were continually thinking evil. They were continually feeding on evil. They were continually looking at this filth and the garbage and filling their minds with it. And oh, how we live in a same kind of world. People are feeding their minds on the filth and the smut and the sewer from the internet and from the television and from the movie industry, filling their minds with smut and garbage and filth. And God says, "I can see the hearts of man, that they're only evil continually." And God says, "I cannot overlook that. Judgment has to come." And how can we possibly think that God's changed His mind and that now we can get away with it and it's okay? Folks, it is not okay. Judgment is coming. God does know what you think. God does know what you watch. God does know what you do. God does know about our lives, and God will judge. We need to be careful the way we carry ourselves, for God sees us. The wickedness of man grieved the heart of God. It grieved God. We see that in verse number 6. "It repented the Lord that He made man on the earth, and it grieved Him at His heart." God saying deep down inside, "I'm so sorry I've made man. I've made man, and look what they've done. They corrupted themselves." And God was grieved down inside. You know, when you do wrong, you grieve God. When I do wrong, I grieve God. When I think evil, when you think evil, it grieves God. It grieves Him. God in heaven, the holy creator of the universe, is grieved in His heart when I do things that are ungodly and displeasing to Him. It grieves Him. Because God is holy, He must punish evil. And He spoke that in verse 7. It says that, "I will destroy man from the earth because man has corrupted themselves." God is holy, and He must defend His holiness and punish sin. But we find here that Noah was a light in a dark world. We read all this wickedness and evil of how God saw their wickedness, and it was only evil continually. And then you read in verse 8, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." But Noah was different. But Noah, the world was full of corruption, but Noah was different. But Noah walked with God. What do we see here about Noah? First of all, we see that he was godly and received God's grace or favor. Noah was just and righteous and perfect in his generation. Verse number 9, He was a just man and perfect in his generation. That doesn't mean he didn't sin at all. It simply means he was spiritually solid. He was a spiritually solid person walking with God. It says that he walked with God like his grandfather Enoch walked with God. He had a close, intimate fellowship with God. Now, my friend, this morning, you've got a choice. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. We've got a choice. We can either walk with God, or we can walk by ourselves. And many Christians, perhaps most, walk through life doing things for God, but not walking with God. Folks, we need a close, intimate walk with God. Now, Noah wasn't the only man that believed in God. He had family members that believed in God. His grandfather, Methuselah, believed in God. His father, Lamech, believed in God. No doubt he had other cousins and relatives that believed in God to a degree. But Noah was different. He walked with God. Now, folks, in our world today, you may have lots of friends that call themselves Christians, and they may or may not be. That's between them and God. But the truth of the matter is, you can be different. You can walk with God. You don't have to be just an average Christian. You don't have to be just an average person that floats along and kind of does what you're supposed to do and keep out of trouble and try to behave yourself and go to church and say your prayers and that's good enough. No, walk with God. See, a walk with God is not a Sunday go to meeting Christian. That's not a walk with God. If the only time you open your Bible is on Sunday when you come to church, you're not walking with God. If the only time you really seriously think about God is on Sunday when you go to church, you're not walking with God. A walk is a step by step, every day, step by step, walking with God, walking with God. That means every day, every moment of every day, I am striving to walk with God. I want a relationship with God. I want fellowship with God. I want to be right with God. I want the Spirit of God working in my life. I want Him to be leading me. I want Him to be guiding me. I want to walk with God. And that's what Noah said. Noah walked with God, just like Enoch walked with God. And God said, because Noah was different, brought him out to the surface, and he said, Noah walked with God, and God gave him his grace, his favor. We see also something very significant, that Noah had God-fearing sons. And you say, Pastor, where does it say that? It doesn't say that. It says, Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. How do I know they were God-fearing sons? Here's how. When flood day came, who got on the ark? Noah, Mrs. Noah, Shem and his wife, Ham and his wife, Japheth and his wife. That's it. Nobody else. Now, Noah had been begging people to get right with God. The New Testament tells us that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. He was preaching to people, get right with God, judgment's coming. Now, it doesn't take too much of an imagination to imagine what happened. You can just imagine all these people out there, crazy Noah. He's out there preaching again. He's been doing this for 100 years, telling us there's going to be water coming down from heaven. We've never seen water come down from heaven before. Why would it do it now? And he says God's going to send this flood. He's making this big boat out there. For what? It's on a dry land. Crazy Noah. Mocking him, laughing at him. But Noah stood firm and he says, I believe God. And I'm going to walk with God. I walked with God for the last all these years, and I'm going to walk with God now. And Noah was 500 years old when he begat sons, three sons. 500 years old. You know, I've often wondered, all of his predecessors had children when they were around 100 or 120, 130 years old. Why did Noah wait until 500? Here's my guess. My guess is God knew judgment was coming, and God withheld Mrs. Noah from conceiving until they were 500 years old, so that those boys would still be young enough and tender enough that they wouldn't be led astray by the wickedness of the world, and they'd be able to help Noah. And they went into the ark with him and then carried on the next generations after the flood. That's my guess. I don't know. But whatever way you want to look at it, those three boys were walking with God, and they got in the ark. Now, Noah taught them godliness. Parents, listen, you cannot expect your children to be godly just because you take them to church on Sunday and just because you put them in a private school does not guarantee anything. You've got to walk with God yourself. They've got to be able to see mom and dad walking with God. Because you cannot say, come on, son, follow Jesus. Just like, follow Jesus like the preacher is. No, that's not going to work. You got to say, follow Jesus like I'm following Jesus. Son, come on, follow me. I'll show you how to do it. I'll show you how to read the Bible. Come on, son, let's sit down. Let me show you how to study the Bible. Let me show you how to dig it out and find things for yourself. Let me show you how to pray. Come on, son, let's go sit aside and pray for a while. Let's just go and let's go talk to people about Jesus. Come on, son, go with me and knock on some doors and tell people about Jesus. Pass out some tracts. You say, oh, I don't think I can do that. Listen, do you want your children to walk with God or don't you? You can't expect it to happen if you don't teach them. You're going to have to put it into their heart. Noah walked with God. Every day he was walking with God and his children followed him because he was walking with God. And you will not get your children to walk with God unless you are walking with God. It's got to start with you, mom and dad. But then it's going to have to be taught. It's not just caught. They catch a lot of it, but you got to teach it as well. It's got to be part of your life. It's got to be part of your family. It's got to be part of your Bible time together. It's got to be part of your conversations. Your whole life needs to be centered around teaching your children. We're studying about this on Wednesday nights. Of helping our children understand how to have a walk with God. Oh, how we need that. And Noah was able to do that. But let me ask you, will you pay the price to walk with God? It'll cost you. No question about it. Are you willing to pay the price to walk with God every step of every day? We find a fourth reason God sent the flood. And that was because of the corruption in the earth, verses 11 to 13. And the earth also was corrupt before God. And the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. All flesh had corrupted his ways upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. God said the world is corrupt. The word corrupt that is used here literally means to be destroyed or ruined or spoiled. God looked at the world and said, the world is destroyed. It is ruined. It is spoiled. It is no longer the world that I created. And the word violence that he uses here is a word that literally means cruelty or wrong or injustice. He said, they're filled with injustice. They're filled with cruelty. They're filled with this violence. And they're an anti-God society that they live in. It was corrupted by man's way or man's lifestyle. The evil lifestyle that man lived. And God was compelled to destroy the earth. You know, there will always be a payday someday. There'll always be a payday someday. And we need to remember that. God cannot overlook sin endlessly. You may get away with sin for a time, but mark it down. Payday's coming. Payday's coming. Moses' words to Israel back in Numbers chapter 32 and verse 23 are still true today. And Moses said, be sure your sin will find you out. Be sure your sin will find you out. Man destroyed the earth with his global wickedness, and God would destroy the earth with a global flood. The same Hebrew word that God translated here for us as corrupt is the word that is translated destroyed back in verses 13 and 17. He says, the world is corrupt, it's destroyed, and I will destroy it. And God says, they destroyed the world with their wickedness, and I will destroy them with a flood. I'll destroy them with a flood. Now this morning, as we've looked at this and made some personal applications in our own lives, we've looked at several different aspects. But we've seen four reasons God sent the flood. God sent the flood because of intermarriage between the godly and the ungodly. God sent the flood because of rebellion. against God. God sent the flood because of wickedness. God sent the flood because of corruption, the violence, the rotten lifestyle that man lived. Now, young people, we need to remember that it's wrong to marry a person that is ungodly. You can't just find somebody that says, oh yes, I'm a Christian. That's not good enough. That is not good enough. You better find somebody that loves God and wants to serve God with all their heart. Otherwise, forget it. Don't even give them a second thought. Even if they're the most handsome guy in the whole world, doesn't make any difference. If he's not a guy that lives for God and loves God, then don't even think about it. Also, remember that displeasing God will ruin your life. It'll ruin your life. Living a life of rebellion will also ruin your life. Young people, rebellion is something that often creeps up in our heart because of the sinfulness of the human nature. But rebellion always causes ruin. It never helps you. If you're struggling with rebellion, the best thing you can do is come to God and get on your face and say, God, I am sorry. And then go and get right with your parents or anybody else that you're rebellious toward. Because rebellion will ruin your life. We need to be careful about trying to hide wickedness in our hearts and our lives, the filthy thoughts. God knows all about that. It's impossible for us to hide things from God. We've also seen here that God sees clearly all of these things. He saw the corruption of the world, that men were destroying the world by their wickedness, their violence, their ungodly lives, their filthy thoughts. The way that man lived was displeasing to God. God said, I've got to judge them. Got to judge them. Now, these sins will not send a true Christian to hell. I mean, there's a lot of true Christians that may be rebellious. That's not going to send them to hell if they're truly a Christian. But you can be sure that they will feel the severe chastening hand of God in their life if they're sinful against God. You cannot sin against God without feeling God's judgment. It will happen. We must learn to follow God like Noah followed God. And my challenge again to you this morning is that you say in your heart, I want to be like Noah. I want to be like Enoch. I want to walk with God. And I am willing to pay the price. I will spend time with God. You know, sometimes it means getting up early to spend time with God in the Word of God and on prayer and on our knees and begging God to work on our life and surrendering our heart to God. It does take work. It does take effort. It does take time. But it's worth it. Will you pay the price to walk with God? If you're here today and do not know Jesus Christ as your Savior, if you can't look back on a time when you came face to face with your sin and God's holiness and your wickedness, and you cried out to God and said, oh God, I'm in trouble. I'm a sinner. I'm doomed. Oh God, you're righteous and holy. And I need your forgiveness and cleansing. And I believe Jesus paid the debt for me. Would you please apply his payment to my life and forgive my sin? If you've never done that, you're still lost. You need to be saved. You need to come to Christ.